The vaccine pool gets bigger here in Florida. Good morning. Hope you had a nice weekend. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this Monday morning, if you are aged 50 or older, guess what? It's time. You can go get the vaccine starting today. Give us a call about that right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, why renters have been hit hardest in this time of pandemic. A new Zillow analysis looks at Jacksonville. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic this weekend, a little more than a year after the novel coronavirus first showed up in our state, Florida topped 2 million cases of COVID-19. Sunday, the State Department of Health also reported that statewide cases ticked up by nearly 4,000. Active hospitalizations have actually gone down, but deaths keep rising. The death toll in Florida now stands at 32,742. And at the same time, nearly 5 million Florida residents have received at least one dose of a vaccine. Now, here's the good news. Starting today, if you are 50 or older, you are now able to receive your shot. At the same time, a new Associated Press analysis of the rollout around the country shows that Florida has handled its overall dissemination of vaccines poorly. Dr. Mobeen Rathore is chief infectious disease specialist at UF's College of Medicine, Jacksonville. He's also professor of pediatrics and associate chair there, and he is on the line. Dr. Rathore, always so good to get your insights in this time we're living through. So good morning once again.
Good morning, Melissa. So good to be with you.
Good to have you. What are your questions, everyone, about vaccine eligibility? If you're 50 or older, you're now eligible to get the shot. We're going to talk about that and a lot of other news around vaccinations. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So, Dr. Rathore, the calls had been growing around the state for weeks for Governor DeSantis to open this up so that more people can become vaccinated at a lot of the sites around the state, including here in Jacksonville. Thousands of doses were going unused each day. So let's begin by getting your reaction to this new eligibility, your thoughts.
Yes, I think the new eligibility is a step in the right direction. I think we need to go even farther than that, make sure that we can have the vaccine available to even a larger pool of Floridians, and frankly, throughout the United States. You know, in any vaccine program, unless we are able to immunize as many people as fast, we are not going to reach that herd immunity goal that we all have. You know, the CDC reported on Saturday, I believe, that only 16.7% of the citizens of the United States are fully immunized, although that number is 40% for those 65 years of age and older. However, I think we can do much better than that. As you said, Melissa, that doses are not being used and are not being used as fast as they can be. You know, the healthcare workers who were the first group, 52% of the healthcare workers have received their first dose, according to Kaiser Family Foundation and Washington Post recent poll. And another 20% are scheduled, and 12% haven't decided. So I think we are making progress. What I would say, the early adopters have already gotten the vaccine, okay? We need to open it up to others now. The vaccine hesitancy, according to NPR, PBS, NewsHour, and Mars's survey, the vaccine hesitancy among Blacks and Hispanics is declining. So if we open it up to a larger population, you are going to get more people to be able to get immunized. While we are focusing on these high-risk groups, I think we need to open it up to much larger group. Frankly, in my opinion, at this time, we should open it up to for Pfizer 16 years and older, and for Moderna and J&J for 18 years and older. Anybody who wants to get the vaccine, come get it.
Yeah. You know, in Orlando and in Miami, they've opened up sites to age 40 and older. They're racing ahead of the governor. Other cities in Florida. The governor has taken a fair bit of criticism for not opening things up more quickly. Should Jacksonville's sites follow suit, Dr. Rathore?
I think so. I think 40 years and above is good. 18 years or 16 years of an older is much better. I think we need to get the young folks immunized. We need to get everybody immunized. You know, we need to get the kids immunized. And Melissa, as you probably know, that we are going to soon start a study in children for coronavirus vaccine here in Jacksonville.
That's right.
We need to get that vaccine approved for children so we can immunize everybody. We are not going to reach our herd immunity goal unless we are able to immunize as many people as we can. So, yes, 40 years is much better than 50, but I think 16 and older is where we should be at now.
Now, let's talk about this. You are a pediatric epidemiologist at U of Health Jax. The hospital's not participating in the study, but some local families are participating, aren't they, in this first trial of the COVID-19 vaccine on children. Moderna is conducting this. It's called KidCove. So yeah. Please share more about this, if you could. This is fascinating.
So I'm a little bit restricted in what I can share because the study is not currently approved by an institutional review board, the human subjects. But what is out there in the press, you all know we have not started the study. University of Florida College of Medicine, UF Health, are the ones who are going to be conducting this study, hopefully starting in a couple of weeks. But as we heard in the news, the KidCove study has started in a few sites around the country where they're going to be immunizing children as young as 6 months of age. So I think we will get there hopefully in a 6 month period or so that we are able to immunize even younger folks, younger than 16 years of age. So I think that study, as you mentioned, is going to happen in Jacksonville. I'm sort of restricted what I can say since we are not approved yet, other than what's available in the media already.
We'll go to your calls for Dr. Mobeen Rathore in a moment. It's 549-2937. You know, over the weekend, we saw the mayor of Miami Beach actually declare a state of emergency and shut down spring break because it had gotten so out of control out there. There were concerns it could become a super spreader event, Dr. Rathore. At the same time, a new AP analysis of the vaccine rollout around the country gave Florida poor marks, saying that we actually are in the bottom 10% of states for overall vaccination performance. Not good to hear that. Other states, according to this study, such as Hawaii, Connecticut, even West Virginia, fared a lot better than we did in Florida. What are your thoughts about how we could have done a better job in this state in handling the vaccination rollout?
Yeah, I think we can do a much better job. I think one of the ways we do a much better job is by decreasing the age. We are getting better at having more sites where we can provide the vaccine. That's great. But I think we also need to be able to provide it to a larger population. Even around the country, only 16.7% of the people are fully immunized. And as I said, for 65 and older, 40%. I believe in Florida, the number for 65 and older is a little bit better. But I think we need to make this access easier. When you hear, and I don't have any specific information that I can say, but what I hear from friends and colleagues and others is that, you know, a site may have 2,000 doses, but they're only using 500 doses. Some of the vaccine sites don't have enough patients. You can just walk in, get the vaccine. I mean, I would hope that we have lines outside the vaccination centers because I know people want the vaccine. So I think make it easier to access the vaccine. You know, why are we still focused on the highly vulnerable population when we have enough vaccines? Why not open it up, to anybody who wants it? Get in line there and get the vaccine.
I know many have asked that same question. Let's go to your calls now for Dr. Mobeen Rathore, UF Health Jacksonville. Have you already been vaccinated? Are you impatiently waiting your turn in line? Call us up now because starting today, anyone 50 or older in Florida can be vaccinated. Other cities like Orlando and Miami have jumped ahead of the governor. They're vaccinating all adults 40 and older. Orlando, Miami, two examples. 549-2937. Sally in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Sally. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I would just implore our county officials in St. Johns County, Duval County, to please open it up to all the whole population, especially those in the tourism and service industries. We have asked that our businesses be open and that we open up to have tourism available, and yet we're not doing anything to protect those, that new front line, those people that have no choice but to serve their customers and their guests as they come in, but have no protection against that against the virus.
Right. Sally, thank you for that. And, you know, Dr. Rathore, Governor DeSantis has disregarded the advice of the CDC and other public health experts with a strong focus on seniors first. It's understandable that we do have a large senior population in Florida, and the majority of Florida residents who are seniors have now been vaccinated, is my understanding. But there's this other population of people who have to interact with the public in tourism-related jobs, food and beverage, grocery store, and other occupations, and they have not been able to be vaccinated yet. It doesn't seem right.
Well, I come back to what I said earlier, Melissa. We need to make it easier. We need to make it open the vaccination to a larger group. I mean, think about this. If we can get offer it to all and anybody who works in the school system, how much better would it be for our children, because they can open this face-to-face schools with much more comfort? I think you're right. All the groups you mentioned, they deserve to be vaccinated. And we are at a stage that those restricted groups for whom we have opened these vaccination opportunities for quite a while, the most of them who want it have already gotten it. There are others who are still hesitant. We know there is vaccine hesitancy, and we know that that's good. Some people are, I mean, the surveys have shown some people are just waiting to see what happens as more and more people get these vaccines. And so if the early adopters have already gotten the vaccine in those restricted groups, why not open it to the others? So let's get them all get the vaccine who can get the vaccine. Now, there may be some concern that we may not have enough vaccine. I'll tell you, my hope and would be that every day, now this may sound callous, but I think I get the point. Every day, people stand in line for vaccines, and few of them cannot get it because the dosage of vaccines are all used. That's where we need to be, not that even you know, few doses are left at the end of the day. We should not be at that place. So I think once we open it up to the groups that Sally had mentioned and the other groups that you have mentioned, I think we will reach that, and then we'll be able to immunize more and more and more and more people.
Robin in Riverside. Hi, Robin. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I have a quick question about I haven't heard this one yet. I'm sure it's out there. My granddaughter, who's almost 3, has been hospitalized twice because of compromised lung before she was a year old, and then about 5 months ago. And I don't think they can call it childhood asthma until they're after 3, but she has inhalers and that type of thing. Her parents are 35 and 38. They're the ones that would very much like to get vaccinated and able to make her less vulnerable. And so that is my question.
Right. Sure. You know, there are so many people like this out there, Dr. Rathore. We hear the stories every day. Do you think as supply keeps ramping up that by April, the floodgates will have opened and everyone will be eligible? I mean, President Biden is saying by May 1st, he wants to have the vaccine available to anyone who wants it. Could it be sooner than that?
Well, I hope it will be sooner than that. But, you know, first of all, sorry, Robin, for your granddaughter. I hope she's doing much better. Yes, it could be sooner than that. And I think it should be sooner than that. Again, it's possible we may not have enough doses when we open it for everybody, but at least we would be able to immunize those who want to get immunized. To Robin's situation, if we could get the parents immunized, we would have what we call cocooning. We know that children are not going to be able to get the vaccine for another 6, maybe 9 months in some age groups. So if we can immunize everybody around them, we will cocoon the children. We will protect the children. So I think it's extremely important that we open it up for those groups also. So perhaps another group could be people who are around vulnerable children who are currently can get the vaccine. So I think these are groups that, there are lots of groups that can benefit for not only for themselves, but those people who are around them. You know, think about it, all these people with, immune compromised conditions, solid organ transplant, you know, they can be protected if people around them are vaccinated.
Tommy on the north side. Hi, Tommy. Thanks for holding. Good morning. Happy Monday.
Hi, how are you?
All right, thanks. Good to talk to you. Go ahead.
So I'd like to first comment on the doctor. The doctor is making some very sound points. But what we really need to concentrate on is the horrible public health rollout of this vaccine. I am an African-American male, 53, who has pre-existing conditions. When this whole thing came out, we had already targeted people like myself as being a red dot as far as, you know, the vaccine needing to be protected, needing to social isolate. I was out of a job for 6 months because I couldn't be exposed because I worked in the actual industry where I was working with a lot of indigent people. So I had to really just like almost go into a shell, you know, until, you know, everything with the social distancing policies and everything took place. And of course, everybody knows everybody didn't follow. But anyway, what I wanted to say about this public health part is that we knew that we should have rolled this vaccine.
Oh,
you know, people are the ones who are closest to this.
Yeah, yeah. Like so, yourself.
So
So
my comment is really to the doctor, the statement that he's making is correct, but what he should say is that if they really want to target the right people, they will make it to the families, make the whole family, the cluster, the whole black cluster, because we don't have health care and we don't have PTO time to take off each time to take grandma, to take her son, take the day kid, take. If we keep doing all these stair step things, we need a whole cluster, and then it'll attack the right population. But we can't make us a.
Yeah, Tommy, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, you know, I hope you get your vaccine today, by the way, if you haven't already. But, okay, Dr. Rathore, you know, Tommy makes such an important point. Vaccine access for vulnerable populations has been a huge issue. The site at Edward Waters College, run by Agape Health, was set up specifically to address this. They're even going into homes now, vaccinating people, the kinds of families that Tommy just mentioned, so that a whole family that has trouble getting to a vaccination site can get some protection. But there's just not been enough of that.
Well, Tommy is absolutely right. I think he's speaking to my heart. I think we could have done a much better job in the public health aspect of it than we did. You know, unfortunately, these inequities in healthcare and disparities, that's nothing new. It's unfortunately, it has just reared this ugly head in the worst form during the pandemic. And yes, we have not done a good job in getting this vaccine to the underserved, to the minorities, to people of color. You know, I'm a brown person. I understand that. I think that is not something that we can be very proud of. Now, I would say one thing, though, Melissa, there was quite a bit of hesitancy in the minority populations. And unfortunately, as I said earlier, there's a latest poll by Marist, PBS, and NPR, which shows that vaccine hesitancy is getting better. But we have to focus on those minority populations. We have to get to the African-American and Hispanic population, those enclaves. We need to make it easier for them to get to. We have to take the mountain to them, okay? We can't expect them to come to the mountain. So I think this is something we could have done a much better job. We still can do a much better job on that. And that has to be a public health focus. It's high time that we got out in those communities. Maybe the state provides mobile vans or whatever. I mean, it should be just like you can knock on the door and get the vaccine. That's what I'm saying. Open it up for everyone.
Lots of tweets about this. Paula tweets the show. My husband and I were vaccinated. We're 65 plus. I'm hoping they get down to the 30-somethings soon. My 32-year-old son got COVID at Christmas last year. Would he still benefit from a vaccine? I believe the answer, doctor, is yes. Yeah?
It's an emphatic yes. An emphatic yes. Yes. If you have had COVID infection, the recommendation is that you can defer up to 90 days. Doesn't mean that you have to. Wait a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, get the vaccine. You should not get the vaccine during the acute COVID-19 infection, but you should actually. There are many other infections, you know, whooping cough, which a lot of people are aware of. If you get a case of whooping cough, you still need to be vaccinated. The fact that you got the infection does not necessarily mean that that infection has conferred a long-term immunity for you.
Bill tweets the show, so glad this is happening and not a moment too soon. Kudos to the military folks, medical workers, and volunteers that have been there for us regardless of the poor leadership from Tallahassee, he says. Perry tweets the show, I'm 44 and I would love to be vaccinated. I have jury duty next Monday. I've been doing everything right over the last year, masking, distancing. This will be the biggest risk to my health so far, all while fulfilling my civic duty. This should be open to everyone, he says. Another tweet, ask the doctor if he believes politics is driving the way the vaccine is being rolled out in Florida. Dr. Rathore.
What I would say is vaccine has to be made easily accessible to everybody. It has to be made easily accessible to all our population. We need to do a much better job on that. I think it's important also that keep in mind that this virus is not one, is not Republican or Democrat. This virus is not black or white. This virus is an equal opportunity infector. And if we don't protect everybody, no one is protected. Keep that in mind. We need to get rid of this pandemic by making sure that we rise above our petty differences and make sure we provide this access to everyone. You know, one of the ladies, I think one of the tweets or somebody said that they have a 32-year-old. We should not stop at 32 years. We should go back even to 16 years of age. We need to do this in a manner so it's so easy that, you know, now opening it up in the various grocery stores, pharmacies and such, I think that's a good thing, but you need to have enough vaccine and make it easy for somebody who's going to buy some eggs to say, by the way, let me get the vaccine. Also, the jury duty is a great opportunity. You send somebody a letter for jury duty and say, here's your appointment for getting your vaccine. Once you get the second shot, then you come for 2 weeks after that, you can come for jury duty. I mean, these are opportunities.
That would make too much sense, Dr. Rathore. But listen, I, as always, I so appreciate your insights. It's great to have you once again, Dr. Mobeen Rathore, UF Health Jacksonville. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Always good to be here. Please keep up the good work. You're doing a great service for our community.
Well, you as well. And again, if you're 50 or older in Florida, you're now eligible to be vaccinated. That's the latest. If you feel like driving down to Orlando or Miami, they're vaccinating everyone 40 and older. So there's that. All right. Much more still ahead later. How you can support an important St. Augustine museum virtually. We'll drop in on the Jimenez Fadio House. But up next.
Education inequity by intentional design is a problem, not just in the South, but it's a problem across the country.
Unequal by design. A new study looks at old patterns in Duval County schools. We'll be right back.
Is the number to call. Give us a call. We're just starting our March spring drive. We're all in this together. Moving forward together is our theme. If you like this program, if you listen every morning, it's your chance to call us up and support this program, First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. Call us now at 353-9528 or go online at wjct.org. And we thank you so much for your support.
Well, it's a landmark study of educational inequity in Duval County, taking a look back at this area's history in our local schools. With more, I spoke with Carolyn Edwards of Community Call. Take a listen. Hey, Carolyn, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into your look at inequities in the local school system, can you tell me a little bit about your family, and what drew you to this subject matter. Your late father, Marvin Edwards, was a well-known civic figure in Jacksonville. So I guess you came by this stuff honestly.
Yes. My father was a well-known gadfly, but most people are aware of my father's work more in the last 20 to 30 years. And the reality is that his work in Jacksonville actually started in 1958. And at that point, I had two brothers already, and my father was very concerned about the Jacksonville public schools, the Duval County public schools, and the poor conditions that they were in, both academically and physically. And so he founded and served as president of the Better School Citizen Committee starting in 1958, and their first focus was on the fire hazards in the public schools, predominantly black schools. Not a lot of people are aware in Jacksonville that there was a dual school system, so there were the black schools and the white schools. And some of the black schools that were being utilized actually dated back to Reconstruction and were still being used in the 1950s. So that was his first initiation, and then he was one of five citizens that called for a grand jury investigation into a corrupt tax assessor at the time who was undervaluing predominantly white property taxes, because those were who owned property in Jacksonville at the time. And as a result of the underfunding of property taxes, there was an underfunding of the public schools, which left them in poor condition for everybody. So he was very involved. And then what I like to say is my favorite thing that my father did was he was involved in the integration of two, it was actually four at the time, but they were segregated teacher groups, associations, and he helped to orchestrate the integration to one union and then helped them to run a successful work stoppage with over 2,000 teachers to get better and more equitable salaries for the teachers. So, and when he passed, I found his files, and I was unaware of how much work my father had done myself on the school system. And being in a doctorate program on with a dissertation focus on education inequity, when I found his meticulous files, and anybody who knew my father knew that he kept everything, there was a very detailed history of what had been going on in Jacksonville during that time. And so I decided to pick up where he left off and show how Duval County was inequity by design after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and how not just how Jacksonville resisted segregation, desegregation, but everything that was done from a political and economic perspective to make sure that the schools were separate and unequal.
And you focus in particular in the decade after the Brown decision, the 1950s and then into part of the 1960s. Right.
1954 to 1964. 1964 is when the Duval County Public Schools lost accreditation of their high schools because they were so inadequate.
Okay. So that's decades ago, but echoes of that systemic inequity persist today. And so as we look at your study, we can draw some lessons from what you've presented. Yes.
That's correct. The premise of my work is that education inequity by intentional design is a problem not just in the South, but it's a problem across the country. There are a tremendous number of urban areas that have inequity that starts with neighborhood segregation. It's referred to as hyper-segregation. And when you have that kind of neighborhood segregation, it impacts everything. And what people don't understand is that the problems with public education are systemic. And you really have to look at the economics, the politics, and the legislation, because all of those impact public education. And then when you have hyper-segregated neighborhoods, then you have the problem that you have black neighborhoods that are suffering from poverty, they are suffering from low property taxes, and historically, white property owners do not want to subsidize public education for black students. But the problem is a national phenomenon, and I look at Duval County as low-hanging fruit because everybody expects that problem to be in the South. And in addition, Jacksonville not only was it well documented with George Peabody College did a review on Jacksonville, some other people did a review at the time documenting it, but there was also a long history of segregationism and racism and Klan activity in Jacksonville. So it's a little easier to show the influence of white supremacy there. But if you look at what's going on a national basis, and you look now, for example, at the voter suppression that's attempts at least that are going on, that voter suppression is very similar to Jim Crow, which was a white supremacy action that was taken. So my whole premise is that white supremacy impacts all of our systems. And ultimately, because education, public education, is controlled by government, that public education is also subject to the rules of white supremacy.
Hmm. Now, not only did you present this in your dissertation, you're also the executive director of Community Call, where you work with marginalized high school kids. Tell us about that.
A Community Call is an organization that I started in officially in 2012. And what Community Call does, it's focused on civic engagement. So we work with marginalized youth in Boston and Cambridge, high school youth, and we discuss news stories that are relevant to them. And sometimes they don't even understand its relevancy. So the whole point of the program is to try to help students to understand that they can get involved and make a difference. And probably one of the best examples I can give you is I worked with a group of students who were at a school called the Reengagement Center, which is part of the Boston Public School System. And the school was designed to bring back students who had become disengaged due to a variety of issues. Could be incarceration or homelessness or whatever. And they decided that the root of problems for students in school was homelessness, that if you didn't have a home and have an address, that it made it hard to attend class, made it hard to do homework, you didn't have access to things. And the bottom line is they set up a program, they decided that in order to do something, they had to let people in power know how hard it was to be a homeless student and to attend school. So we ended up setting up a project with, at the time, the brand new mayor of Boston, who's now the new labor secretary, Marty Walsh. And we ended up putting on a program that brought in about 80 youth that we say living on their own because many of them don't identify as homeless. And they met with the health commissioner, who's now the health commissioner out in L.A., and the mayor and some other people. And as a result of that, there was a corporate sponsor that gave over $2 million in grants to organizations that were focused on dealing with youth homelessness. And the mayor made a personal commitment to end youth homelessness, and this year has arranged for housing for over 100 homeless youth in Boston. So it made a huge difference, but that's the type of thing that we do is teaching civic engagement, because civic engagement is, you know, I feel it's another form of white supremacy. It's not taught in poor schools or schools that predominantly serve black and brown students.
Hmm. This is fascinating stuff. Where can people go to learn more about your work?
Well, Community Call has a website, communitycall.org, and they can learn more about the work there. And in terms of my research, if anybody has any questions, they can email me at carolynedwardsphd@gmail.com.
Carolyn Edwards, thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Well, a new report out from Zillow this week says lower-income renters have had the hardest time in this pandemic. Now, you might expect that in bigger cities where the rent is incredibly high and cost of living is high. But this holds true even in more affordable cities like Jacksonville, where rent is outpacing people's incomes. Chris Glynn is a senior economist with Zillow, and he's on the line to share more. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to talk to you. Now, you've just put out some February numbers for the Jacksonville Metro. Let's talk about rent. The typical rent in this city is just under $1,400 a month. That's according to Zillow, a 6-point increase from a year ago, correct?
Yeah, rent is increasing. In fact, we're seeing across all price tiers of the rental market, rents are increasing in Jacksonville. So rents for the lowest income earners and for the highest income earners, rents are increasing about 6% in Jacksonville.
And you're finding this in medium-sized, allegedly more affordable cities like Jacksonville all over the country. What's driving this?
Well, in Jacksonville, we've seen that throughout the pandemic, there's been really a push towards sort of two main themes. And the first one is affordable housing. We've seen that as workers have become untethered from physical office locations, that when they have the opportunity, in many cases, they've chosen to relocate to areas that are more affordable, whether that means relocating across cities or relocating within the same metro, but perhaps taking on what would have otherwise been a longer commute. And the second main theme that we've observed is a desire for year-round and outdoor living. And so given the constraints of the pandemic and that we've all been confined to our homes for so long, we've seen both renters and buyers place a premium on locations where they can have access to outdoors more year-round, which opens up more socially distant and safe activities. And so Jacksonville actually sits at the intersection of two of these main themes.
So on the one hand, that's good news because we're seeing a real appreciation in home values. That's good for people who want to build wealth through their house, which is usually their biggest asset. That's really doing well. But it's not good news.
In fact,
go ahead.
I was just saying, in fact, in Jacksonville, we've seen home values increase 10% from this time last year. So not just rents that are increasing, but home values that are rapidly increasing. And in Jacksonville, it's really only taking about 7 days for the typical home to be sold. So markets are moving incredibly quickly.
Wow, 7 days. And so are you seeing a lot of people buying here in our area from the Northeast? Who are the typical buyers?
That's a great question. The relocation data and migration data is very difficult to get because in real time, it's hard to estimate, you know, how people are moving from, say, New York or Boston to Jacksonville. But we do hear anecdotal stories of exactly that, people relocating from the Northeast down to Florida. But as far as exact data, it's difficult to get.
But certainly we are seeing that in metros around Florida. So, okay, so there are two tracks to your data. The good news for homeowners, their home values just keep going up and up. And the bad news for renters, rent is just becoming incredibly high. And for people who are scrambling to make ends meet in this pandemic, that's terrible news. And so tell us a little bit more about, how this is affecting the economy, because there are a lot more renters out there than people paying a mortgage. And this is a real pain point for them.
It is. And connecting with the theme of your last interview, one of the things that Zillow has researched in the past is connections between rising rent and homelessness. And we've found that when renters tend to spend more than 30% of their monthly income on rental costs, homelessness in the city tends to rise. And so it's a pressure point that reaches all households, because when you pay for healthcare and housing costs and all the essentials, at the end of the day, there's less and less left over for daily living. And that's hitting renter households disproportionately hard during the pandemic, as so many of them have been impacted by economic disruptions, whether it's in retail or hospitality. And renters have really borne the brunt of the economic disruption during the pandemic.
Yeah, I don't know if you've covered or followed this, Chris, but of course, in Jacksonville, we had a pretty large downtown tent city of folks without any housing. The city has been working to clear out the tent city and get people at least into temporary housing. Because, in recent years, cities have finally come around to what advocates have been saying for a long time, which is that the best way to help homeless people is to give them housing. find them a roof, get them some resources and help them get a job. We are starting to see that more and more here. And so as you have the bird's eye view, you're looking all across the country. I'm assuming you're seeing that kind of activity everywhere. Tell us more about how we stack up to other cities this way.
So as far as Jacksonville's cost of renting, it's similar to places like Tucson, Arizona, and Memphis, Madison, Wisconsin, and Virginia Beach. And so rent in Jacksonville is about half of what it costs to live in San Francisco or San Jose. The rent in Jacksonville in the metro area in February was almost $1,400. Rent in the Bay Area was $2,800. But the way that we think about it is not necessarily rent in terms of absolute terms, but more about the relationship between rent and the local economy. So when thinking about housing affordability and rent affordability, we really want to think about what is the cost of rent in terms of the fraction of monthly income for most renters. And that's really the way that we want to think about the cost of rent for metros around the country.
So again, let's repeat this one more time. As Chris said, if you're spending more than 30% of your monthly income on rent, you're out of balance. That you want to be shooting for around 30% of your income on housing costs, but that's just simply not possible given the current market conditions for so many Americans, Chris. So, do apartment communities, do they have a responsibility to, I mean, there have been efforts to provide more affordable housing in this city, but there's just not nearly enough to meet the demand.
I think that it's not really my place to comment on the responsibility of individual apartments, but I do think that as a priority and as a community, recognizing the value of affordable housing because of the opportunities that it creates for families and building community and welcoming new people into a community. As you said, that it's just not possible when rents are increasing so much faster than incomes for everyone to keep up. And so it's a very difficult time for renters, and recognizing and making housing affordability a priority for policies at the local, state, and federal levels, I think is something that is important.
Great to get your insights. He's Chris Glynn, a senior economist with Zillow. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And still to come, we will drop in on the Jimenez Facio House Museum. Say that three times fast. In St. Augustine, how you can support them this week. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
In 1923, the town of Rosewood was burned to the ground in a racially motivated attack. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Rosewood descendant Lizzie Jenkins. We'll discuss the history of public health in Florida and the practice of redlining in Jacksonville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, correcting the record on Lady Bird Johnson. Writer Julia Swag says the First Lady, regarded as the genteel advocate of highway beautification, was far more. A savvy political advisor to President Lyndon Johnson and an advocate of ambitious programs to protect the environment and fight urban blight. Swag's new book is In Plain Sight. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
For decades, police in Texas have used hypnosis to solve crimes. Not anymore. The state's now decided to drop the technique after a year-long investigation by the Dallas Morning News. What now for those serving time based on evidence that critics say is nothing more than junk science? That story and the latest news next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
When you listen to WJCT News 89.9, there's a sense that we're moving forward together. It's why public radio in Jacksonville works. WJCT News 89.9 gives you the information you need to make sense of the world around you. Your investment of any size helps make the news happen. Please donate now at WJCT.org or call 904-353-9528. And thank you.
Welcome back. Well, today is your chance to support an important site in the nation's oldest city. Dr. Roger Smith is director of the Jimenez Facio House Museum in St. Augustine. Dr. Smith, thanks for calling into the show. Good morning.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And I'm pretty sure I mangled the name of the museum a couple of times on the air, so I apologize for that.
Oh, on the air? Well, it's great just then.
All righty, good. So the Colonial Dames are holding something for your museum. It's called Auction for Action to benefit the museum. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, tell us a little bit about the importance of this place.
Well, the museum is more than just another old home. It is it was an early business, and it was built in 1798. So to give perspective on that, John Adams was president.
Yeah.
George Washington was still alive. So it's an old home. But from 1830 to 1875, it was owned consecutively by three single women and run as a boarding house. And that in itself is amazing, that women were able to find a way not only to own property, but to run a business, a legitimate business, and a legal business.
Yeah.
And then we've just recently discovered and staged and opened up our third floor, which is where the servants and enslaved servants lived during the course of the history of the house. So it has an amazing amount of women's history, of African American history, of Southern culture history, a business history.
This has been rated the top museum in St. Augustine, which is pretty impressive given all the history there. And so you're asking people to support your Auction for Action. Tell us about how they can be part of this.
Auction for Action is an auction that allows us to raise money. We are a 501c3, and we have an opportunity through this auction to purchase items that, and bid on items that can go straight to the museum and help keep us restored. The Colonial Dames have done a phenomenal job since they bought the house in 1939 and restored it, to build the artifacts collection and keep everything historically accurate in that sense. It's the preservation of the building. And even though it's almost entirely made of coquina and as sturdy as the fort, you still have a lot of wood in here. And so you have to be tended for termites every now and then, and you have to replace wood that's 150 years old and that kind of thing. So it takes a lot of paint and elbow grease.
So they need to visit your website then and give what they can, because this auction ends up today.
Yes. What you actually do, I'm going to give you where you go to. Rather than going to our website, you simply go into your address bar and type in X as in X-ray, F as in Frank, H is in Henry, M is in Mary. So xfhm2021.ggo.bid, B-I-D.
I hope you people remember that. You might want to say that one more time.
I'll say that 10 more times.
Well, we're almost out of time, so one more time quickly.
Sure. xfhm2021.ggo.bid.
Okay. Support Jimenez Facio House in St. Augustine. Director Roger Smith with us. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Okay, and before we go, we also ask you to support public media on the First Coast. Our station manager, David Luckin, is here to tell us a little bit more about that. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good to see you. You're the first live guest we've had in this studio in 1 year.
Yeah, that's where bells and whistles.
Believe it?
It's nice to be here. Then I'm happy to be the first guest. And we want to remind people that we're into our first spring drive of the year, and our theme is Moving Forward Together. We thank so many of you for being with us through this extraordinary year. We've all been challenged in so many ways, and we are happy that you chose us to keep you informed and entertained and diverted from all this craziness. So give us a call, if you can, at 353-9528. If you can't, we totally understand these are extraordinary times, but if it's within your means, call us now at 353-9528.
Because, you know, we are pleased to report that because of our growing community of listeners, we have enjoyed record ratings in this pandemic. People are really hungry for information. And if you're one of them and you value what we do here at WJCT, give us a call this week and pledge what you can at 353-9528 or online at WJCT.
And we thank you so much for your support. And again, we do realize that some people aren't able to support us right now. We are here for you anyway. We want you to keep listening every day, every minute. But if you can, give us a call at 353-9528. We thank you in advance for helping us provide great programming for the whole community.
And I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, having an actual human being in here with me for the first time in over a year. This is a big deal.
This is nice.
I am really excited.
Should have brought in some tea or something. We could have a little tea time while we talked.
I know. Maybe some, you know, some Krispy Kreme donuts.
There you go.
Anyone that gets vaccinated, you get the free Krispy Kreme starting today. So that's kind of cool, too.
Thanks for allowing me in your space.
And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Baptist Health and Wolfson Children's Hospital are here for children in or at risk of a mental health crisis. Our 24/7 Kids and Teens Helpline is staffed by mental health experts and available to parents.